Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lori Loeb. Lori's been many things in her life, a percussionist, a silversmith, a ski instructor, cocktail waitress, carpenter, landscaper, newspaper reporter, ESL teacher, yoga instructor, music therapist, a business owner, and a community organizer. It's through her role as a community organizer that she helped found the Carbondale Council on the Arts and the Carbondale Mountain Fair that now draws over 20,000 people each summer. I sat down with Lori recently at her kitchen table to talk about her life in the valley and what's next. Lori Loeb, thanks for sitting down with me for this interview. I really appreciate your time. I'd like to start by asking you how you came to the valley. What were the circumstances that brought you here?
I originally came to play in the Aspen Music Festival and school while I was still in high school. I have been playing percussion since I was 12 years old. I'm not just a hippie thunder drummer like a lot of people see me. I had been playing in a repertory orchestra in New York City and doing monthly Carnegie Hall concerts and weekly radio broadcasts of rehearsals. I was on a fast track to become a symphonic percussionist. And the Aspen Music School, of course, has a great reputation. And so I came out here to that in the summer, as I said, while I was still in high school. And of course, like everybody, I fell in love with the place. And as a child, at the age of 12, I had been in the Italian Alps and was totally enthralled with them. And I arrived in Aspen at night, so I couldn't really see my surroundings. And when I woke up the next morning and looked out my window, it was like, oh my God, I'm back in Cortina d'Ampezzo. And that was it. And then after junior year in college, I dropped out of school and moved here. So that was 61. I moved to Aspen, and I was up valley all during the 60s. And then I could see from around the mid-60s on, I could see the changes that lay ahead. And decided I didn't really want to stay in Aspen. And I looked all over other places, other ski areas, but for various reasons chose not to go to them, and decided that I wanted to stay in proximity to Aspen because of the cultural activity. And Carbondale didn't have much going on, and it was very affordable, and this is where I landed. People would say to me up valley, what the heck are you going to do in Carbondale? And I kind of wondered myself, but I figured it out.
You did indeed. So describe what Aspen was like first, and then we'll get to Carbondale. But what was your first impression when you came in, what, 1958?
58, yeah. No, it was earlier than that. I came in 57 the first time, yeah. Aspen had a year-round population of about, 700 people, and the highway was the only paved road. There were dogs sleeping in potholes in the streets and, maybe one car parked on a block. And it was very laid back and wonderful. And, there were a lot of social dropouts there. And people came there to live however they chose to live. And it was a very eclectic group of people.
Who are some of the dropouts that you remember? Were there particular characters, or was it?
Oh yeah, well, Ralph Jackson. He was one of the big characters, and there were a lot of very interesting people, and then there were the people who started the ski industry who were there, and a bunch of Scandinavians and Europeans. And we had Hungarian refugees and just it was just a really interesting place. And it wasn't a pretentious place at all.
What were the changes that you saw that made you sort of decide to move on down?
They started building condos, and what that represented was absentee ownership, and that really changed the face of the town. There were people who were, you know, owning properties there and trying to control the way the real residents lived. Also, they started to pave the streets, and I lived on a corner, and they were going to slap a huge pavement assessment onto me. They started to put a leash law in effect, and these were right. The kind of things that I just didn't care for.
So you moved to Carbondale, and what did you find when you came here? It was 1970.
Well, I bought my place in 69. Wally DeBeck had 3 houses in a row for sale here, and he was asking $15,000 for all 3 of them. And I offered him 10, thinking he'd come back, you know, with a counter offer, and he said, take them. And he financed them for me. This one that I currently live in had been abandoned for 5 years, was condemned, and totally uninhabitable. The other 2 had very leaky roofs and bad plumbing and bad wiring, and were rented for, I can't even remember how much, but very, very low rentals. And the town had 600 people and no paved roads at all. And it was, you know, the population were primarily coal miners, ranchers, and a few people who worked, you know, for the schools or the Forest Service or something like that. It was a very low-key town. There wasn't much going on. There was one restaurant, Tijo's, which was where European Antiques is on Main Street now. And then what's next door to European Antiques now, which is a town restaurant, was an auto mechanics shop. And, you know, some of the storefronts on Main Street were boarded up. The library was in the west end of the Dinkle Building in what's now a florist shop. And it had the largest circulation of any library on the Western Slope. And yeah. It was just in a little storefront.
Libraries were hard to come by in those days. I do remember that, having grown up in Glenwood. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lori Loeb. Lori's describing her life in Carbondale when she arrived in 1969. So did you know what you were going to do when you came to Carbondale, when you looked around?
No. No. Just took a stab in the dark. I had my work cut out for me with these houses. I mean, I had to renovate one of them to live in it. And then I wanted to ski, and I really couldn't afford to ski, so I started teaching skiing up at Sunlight. And Sunlight seemed like an anthill, you know, compared to Ajax, where I'd been skiing, you know, every day except maybe 5 or 6 a season. And then I needed a little spending money, so I went to work as a cocktail waitress at Buffalo Valley initially, where I got sent home from my first night at work for not having hose on my legs or makeup on my face. But we worked that out.
How did you do that? How did you work it out?
Well, I was wearing, my first night at work, I was wearing what I had been wearing for my interview and got hired in. I thought it was perfectly acceptable. but the bartender didn't. And I just told him, you know, I'm clean. I'm going to do my job well. And this is who I am. I don't wear makeup. I'm not going to wear makeup.
What was it like in 1970 in Carbondale? The war, the Vietnam War was winding down, and there were people moving to this area, yourself and others. So as I remember, having grown up in Glenwood, there was a bit of a conflict between the hippies and...
Oh, yeah. Well, at first, you know, I didn't really know anything about coal mining culture, and I would go to the post office. We didn't have, you know, home mail delivery then, and I'd go to the post office every day, and I'd see guys with black eyeliner on, looked to me like mascara, and I thought to myself, good Lord, what kind of a weird cult is this? Not having a clue that this was coal dust on the base of their eyelashes and they couldn't get it off. The Black Nugget was in full swing, and that's where the miners hung out. And because rents were very cheap here, some artists started moving in, and a few people started moving down Valley from Aspen. Roy Rickus moved down soon after me, you know, with his turban, and we just started seeing more more diversified population here. And there were some problems, between the so-called hippies and the miners and the ranchers, but we managed to work those things out. And I think one of the things that was instrumental in that was the beginning of Mountain Fair. That was a way to bring diversified population together in a common on common grounds of the arts.
Really? So it played a role. I've often wondered how that tension was diffused in Carbondale, and how people, the residents, finally came to accept folks.
Well, you know, a lot of problems like that stem from ignorance and lack of understanding. It's like when the Latinos first came, there was a communication barrier, and so people are afraid of the unknown. And that's what it was like back in the early 70s. Once people got to know each other and to work together side by side, you know, like on Mountain Fair, then people began to realize we're all pretty much the same. We might look a little different, but, you know, inside we've got the same needs. We're human beings. And I think we developed, you know, some mutual respect. You know, in some cases, just tolerance. But in many cases.
Tolerance is good, at least for a starter, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, after the first couple of years of Mountain Fair, we started the Arts Council, and I was very adamant about involving various segments of the community in that. And so when I formed a board for CCAH, I got somebody from the schools, somebody from the clergy, Jean Holgate, who was the town clerk. I got her to be the co-signer on the bank account so that there would be the credibility of those people who were already known here. And that worked, too.
Well, so you're a community organizer of sorts and respecting the different segments of the community and making an effort to involve them is a good place to start.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Lori Loeb. Lori's talking about the early days of organizing the Mountain Fair. So how did you engage people in Mountain Fair? Was there resistance? I mean, you had to first of all describe and educate people about what it was.
Well, originally, the State Council on Arts and Humanities came to Carbondale wanting to host a Chautauqua Festival. And they went to the college and got somebody from the college to be the organizer. And she was in an auto accident a couple of weeks before the fair was scheduled and couldn't continue. And George Stricker, who was working for the college at the time, approached me because I had put together some crafts fairs up in Aspen. I had been a silversmith when I was up there. And so he knew that and came to me to see if I would do it. And so on 2 weeks' notice, we managed to put together the first fair. And we decided, you know, why should we just take a look at the work of artists who they're bringing in from outside? We've got some of our own. At the time, we had a mayor, Charlie Kelly, who was a bronze sculptor. And we had a number of different artists and weavers, potters, etc., who had already moved down here. So we decided, let's showcase our own artists as well as getting some exposure to what's going on in the outside world. And so, and then, you know, we thought, okay, we'll get the Boy Scouts involved. They were painting rocks and making seed necklaces. And the Rebeccas were doing their quilting. And again, it was an inclusive attitude. You know, let's come together and celebrate what we've got.
Well, and Potato Days was a rich tradition. So
oh, yeah.
People had things, and they could see how this would be another sort of way to celebrate a festival.
Right. And you know, because of Potato Days and because this was a small, you know, agricultural community, there was a tradition of volunteerism. It's always been very strong here. Soper's Park was built by volunteers. And so in the early years of Mountain Fair, I mean, we had like 500 volunteers. We wanted to block off Went Boulevard, and Vern Soucy was the police chief at the time, and he had just come to town. And he said, oh, no way, you know, you'd have to have people directing traffic and they'd need training. I said, tell me how many you want, I'll get them. And I called him up a couple of days later. I said, okay, you know, when do you want to train us? And so we had a lot of volunteers, and, you know, there wasn't a permanent bandstand, and the farm co-op would provide a flatbed truck, and Flogus sawmill would provide the siding to build a structure. And we built a structure every year and then tore it down. And people built their booths. There were none of these little fancy pop-up tents then.
So
it was a do-it-yourself culture.
Yeah. But you said you had five. How did you marshal 500 volunteers? That's amazing in the early days of the Mountain Fair.
Well, I that was probably after a couple of years. I guess my enthusiasm was infectious.
Yeah.
When I believe in something, you know, I can sell the idea.
Yeah, I would say.
And you know, and I got a lot of people involved in the decision making, so then they all would have a sense of ownership, and that you know, translates into a sense of pride for what's happening. You know, let's make this work.
So it was never yours, it was ours.
It was
always
ours. Which
is an important place to start.
You know, you need somebody, you know, like an umbrella to oversee all the different pieces, but you need so many to make things really happen.
And it really did happen. When did the drum circle happen?
Oh, gosh. Well, the drum circle didn't start till, I don't know, probably about 17 years ago. It was the year of the Great Ball of Fire that it was a power surge, I guess, from the station up on 133, and it blew out all the electrical power south of the railroad tracks. And there was this big fireball that traveled along an electrical wire across, was it 7th Street, from the park across the street. And I was standing right under it, and it was like a dragon breathing fire. It was just amazing. It made a loud sound, you know, a whoosh, and you could feel the energy. It wasn't the heat that you could feel, but the energy and the sound. I mean, it was just jaw-dropping. And it blew the power out like 15 minutes after the fair started. And I was scheduled to be facilitating some drum circles on Saturday and Sunday in the Oasis in the kids area. And Thomas, who was the director of the Arts Council at that time, said, "Go home and get your drums." And so since I live so close to the park, that was done. And within about 20 minutes of the power going out, we had a drum circle of about 80 people going. So that was the beginning of the drum circle. And that was, like I say, about 17 years ago. And I always thought of it as the Fireball commemorative drum circle.
Well, where did 80 drums come from?
Oh, I had a lot of stuff. yeah, like I said, I've been a percussionist since I was 12 years old, and I've gathered up instruments all over the world. But I also had started in 98. I started facilitating drum circles in schools and in community events and with special needs populations. And so I had acquired much more equipment to supply people with.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with Lori Loeb. She's describing the genesis of the drum circle at Mountain Fair. What brought you to that drum circle idea?
I moved my mother out here. She had severe dementia, and after my father passed away, I brought her out here, and she was in what's now Heritage Park. It was a privately owned facility at the time, and I went soon after she came out. I visited her. I mean, I was out there every day, and I saw that the programming for the residents was really abysmal. I mean, there wasn't much going on for them. And I had been acquainted with the therapeutic aspects of rhythm and drumming. In fact, when I was still in middle school, I was doing volunteer work in hospitals. I had been interested in drum circles, and so I thought, you know, that'd be a really neat thing. And I didn't really know much about how to do that. So I started, you know, studying up, and I designed a prototype program for Heritage Park. And before I even started conducting it, Mountain Valley Developmental Services contacted me, said that they heard what I was doing and they wanted to get in on it too. And so I, you know, fudged my way through, you know, on a volunteer basis. And that summer, I knew about the trainings that were offered. There was a week-long training that I really, really wanted to go to by the granddaddy of drum circles. And I managed to get a scholarship from the Arts Council to go get trained. And I was wondering, you know, when I came back from the training, you know, how am I going to practice this stuff? And then it was that the following summer that the Fireball started the first drum circle. So it was just perfect.
The Fireball.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And the drum circle has become quite a phenomena in itself. I hear from people all the time, "Oh, you know, it's my favorite part of the fair," or "I come for the drum circle, but then I leave for the rest of the weekend." And it's just such a wonderful way to bring people together in one pulse, to set the tone of harmony within diversity.
That was Lori Loeb, a Valley treasure whose name is synonymous with giving, caring, and commitment. If you'd like to hear the rest of my interview with Lori, please go to our website, kdnk.org. You can click on the public affairs at the top of the page and scroll down to immigrant stories. It's there that you'll find today's interview and its second half. Thanks to all of you for listening, and a special thanks to Lori Loeb for all that you've given. Our valley is a richer and more vibrant place because of you.